You wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Your arm. I see we forgot something. It's an, interesting antique. Quite nice, really, from a collector's point of view. The Plymouth Deluxe of the robotics age, before we really got good at bioengineering. I don't know if you want to keep it, but if you'd rather update it to, say, a replica of your old arm, I know a guy in Almaty. He's very good. He did one of our staff after a suicide bombing. Two new legs, and you couldn't even see the scar. I definitely wouldn't recommend the local hacks here. Oh, you know someone in Hong Kong? Well, that's fine then. On your form, you wrote one word, Napoleon. We get this request a lot. Napoleon is extremely popular. If all we did were Napoleon tours, we'd probably be booked up until the end of the century, so we have a few good ones in the vault. Between you and me, we do get a few strange requests for Napoleon. Some people want to kill him. Others want to have sex with him. Some have death wishes to die in his grand army. But most simply want to wear a fancy uniform and go on an adventure. From what I know of you, I'd guess you're in that last category. You don't seem like the type to just hang out in Paris and go to operas. Oh, and I should mention, in this world we're sending you to, Paris really is quite the city. Beethoven moved there, and Goethe, and, well, pretty much the entire cultured class of the continent. But, of course, you'll be on campaign, far from the coffee shops and the Schubert. Napoleon never intended to march on Moscow in 1812. He wanted a big decisive battle with Tsar Alexander that would knock out the Russians. In the world we're sending you to, Napoleon got his battle, but Alexander ran. Rather than chase him, Napoleon wintered safely in Poland. Each summer, Napoleon struck into Russia, pacifying just a little bit more, and each winter, he returned to safety. Russia became an obsession for Napoleon. He spent 10 years hunting down the Tsar across the vast steppe, but was never able to kill him. Meanwhile, the English were being a real nuisance. They were blockading the whole continent and were conducting guerrilla operations in Spain. Napoleon decided it was finally time to give up trying to outsmart the wily Tsar and strike the insolent English where it hurt. And so, Napoleon detached a few hundred thousand from his Russian campaign and rebranded them the Army of India. Please put on your costume now as I finish your orientation. We're sending you back to the year 1822. You'll begin your journey in Moscow, where our agent has signed you up for Napoleon's Army of India. You'll start marching in the spring, and will hopefully arrive in India before winter. We are attaching you to a man called Jean-Francois. He's an officer of the Imperial Guard and is very well respected for his countless battles going back to Italy, Napoleon's earliest campaign. he is so well respected for his steadfast devotion that he now heads Napoleon's personal bodyguard. You will be his assistant, scrub his pots, cook his food, polish his buttons, and always make sure he has a loaded rifle. Well, step out and let's have a look at you. Classic. You look great. The blue overcoat and the white vest and the pants, very nice. The red cuffs and collar, the epaulets, the crossed shoulder belts, and that classic bicorn hat. Turn around, let's see you. Yes, I do love the tails and the turnbacks. Oh, don't forget your ammunition pouch and your knapsack. And your rifle, of course. You'll need all these things. They're on the floor, just over there. Please, step on the platform, and we'll get you on your way. You're going to feel a bit dizzy, and you might not remember where you are at first. You know the drill. Just wait it out, and it will all come clear. Now, I should mention, Napoleon is not a healthy man. He has cancer. It's a hereditary thing, and we haven't found a parallel universe yet where he lived past 60. Sometimes he succumbs to it early, sometimes late. So just keep in mind that he might start to show symptoms while on campaign. He'll be 53 after all. A snowflake floats through the bitter night air and lands on your bayonet. You bring your rifle close and gently blow. It melts into a teardrop and rolls down the razor-sharp edge. Beyond the dark hills floats the sound of drunken revelry. Cutlery clicks. There's laughter, intermittent singing of catchy French songs cut through the exotic Persian instruments that drone on, unaware of their European audience. Jean-Francois shivers. "Cold night," he says, and shakes his legs. You're suddenly aware of the pain in your own leg. You've been standing in front of Napoleon's tent for hours, and your legs feel like chains. They're cast iron hard, but they feel like they could collapse without your constant willpower to sustain them. These legs have taken you across Asia, from Moscow to the very gates of India. "Do you think we'll make it through the Khyber Pass before it really starts snowing?" you say to Jean. He looks up at the night sky, blinking his eyes against the snowflakes that land in his lashes. "To be honest, I don't even know if we're going to India anymore," he says. "What? What do you mean? Of course we're going to India." Well, Napoleon's dying, and the marshals are drinking with the Persian Shah, so I'd say we might just swing around and go home. Somehow I doubt it. Well, you're entitled to your opinion. How would you explain it? The treaty with the Persians? Oh, I don't know. We've been kind of a disaster in their territory, forging and looting. I can see why the Shah didn't want us to pass through in the first place. But now that we're finally leaving, what's the point of keeping a war going? Because that's the best time to strike. Okay, whatever you say, you old pessimist. I am not a pessimist. I'm a realist. And the reality is that going to India is death. We'd be much better off returning home. Death? Well, that is dramatic. We have 300,000 soldiers. The British don't have a tenth of that in India. How is India death? India isn't death. It's going to India that is going to kill us. Let me guess. The Khyber Pass. Yes, the Khyber Pass. You've been playing up the Khyber Pass since we left Moscow. No one else talks about it. Listen. I've heard all your gripings about the pass. The Pathans and the Pashtuns, and how Alexander had to fight a little battle, and how Genghis Khan was too scared to take his army through, if that's even true. I've heard all your rumblings, but I'll tell you, worst comes to worst. We run into some hill tribes and are delayed a few days. Then, we're in India. I think that's what we've got to focus on, is India. Jean-Francois draws a hand down his long mustache. Even through the moonlight, you can see his fingers are cracked and dry like the Afghan valleys. And what do you know of the pass? Have you ever been through it? No. No, well, then you don't know. I have heard it said that every stone is washed in blood. That's called poetry. Jean looks off into the distance, listening to the marshal singing songs. It's useless fighting with him. When he gets an idea, it's almost impossible to convince him otherwise. You know, I think your stubbornness is what makes you such a good bodyguard, you say. You don't budge. Nothing could move you but Napoleon himself. He snorts a quick laugh, then his face returns to his regular mope. Maybe Wellington could budge me, if he's waiting for us in the pass. The English in the Khyber Pass? You do have an imagination. Who knows what's waiting for us in those mountains? You gaze out to the hills with him as the marshals roar in laughter. It strikes you that Jean could be right. You really don't know what lurks in the pass, and it would make for the perfect ambush. Nowhere else on your journey would the army of India be so exposed. You'll be strung out in a great, long line, with miles separating the first man from the last. Even a vastly inferior enemy could wreak havoc. You know, Jean, you're probably right. Who knows what's out there? Horse hooves clap in the night. Jean lifts his rifle, and you see the flash of his bayonet in the moonlight. You and the other guards quickly raise your own rifles. Whoa, hey, put those down, Viktor Tajevich says. How is forging? Jean says, and takes the horse's reins.
Not great, I'm afraid. At least the Persians have stopped shooting us.
He slips his leg over the saddle and leaps down. Even in the darkness, you can see his long, golden hair trailing behind him in ringlets. Jean and Victor embrace. Sometime during the long march from Moscow, they stopped hiding their relationship.
"I have this for you," Victor says, and hands Jean a bag.
"What is it?"
"A bit of goat meat. We took it from a shepherd. The men devoured most of the animal, but I managed to save you a piece."
"That is kind of you. Thank you, Victor."
Jean-Francois looks back at you and the other guards, and you feel your stomach churning, hopefully.
"Don't worry, we'll share it,"
Jean says. The guards grunt their approval.
"But not now. No fires around Napoleon's tent. We don't want to draw attention."
"Are they still going?"
Victor says, turning in the direction of the party.
"They've been going all night. I imagine they'll be going all morning, too."
"I wonder what they're eating. I bet it's soaked in horrible spices."
"Ah, now, don't be jealous, Victor. It's marshals only."
"Jealous? I'm not jealous.
But I should be at that party. I'm a colonel of the 13th Polish Hussars."
A raspy cough comes from Napoleon's tent.
"He should be at that party," Jean says, looking past the dark tent flaps.
"Hey, listen to that."
"What?"
"Shh, just listen. The party. It's gone quiet."
"That's odd. They were singing just a moment ago."
"I don't like this. Not one bit. Guards, stand ready."
An arrow thuds into the neck of the guard next to you. Another whistles right past your ear.
"It's an attack!"
Jean shouts and shoulders his rifle. It belches fire that ignites the valley like a strobe light. For a split second, you see shapes of men in turbans and robes, captured in time as they rush towards you, long curved blades like lightning in their hands. You shoulder your own rifle, and it lights up the mountains with a great thundering boom. The other guards do the same. Victor mounts his horse just as the Persians are about to grab him. He cuts them down as though he were pruning a hedge. Before you can reload, more muzzle flashes appear, this time from the camp behind you. French soldiers of the Imperial Guard rush into the clearing to surround Napoleon's tent. The surviving Persian assassins scatter into the night. Jean orders a square, three men deep, to be formed around Napoleon's tent, and fires to be lit on all the edges. As the men are busying about, Jean runs into the darkness in the direction of the party. You and Victor follow with a few guards in tow. The Persian tent glows red against the dark hills. As you approach, your heart thumps in your chest. There are shadows cast against the silk walls, but no movement, no sounds. Jean opens the flap and steps inside. Victor follows.
"Those bastards," Victor says.
You enter the tent. The first thing you see is a long wooden table covered in heads. The heads of French marshals. You recognize all their faces. Davout, Ney, Oudanot, Brunet, Soult. These are faces you laughed with, cursed at, and respected to the point of reverence. Napoleon's marshals. They fought at Austerlitz, Vienna, Petersburg, and the Nile. They led the greatest armies in Europe in the greatest battles the world had ever seen. Each marshal was a Caesar in his own right, and was deserving of the most splendid Roman triumph. Now, their severed heads lie on platters, their lips still foaming from poison. Their bodies lie around the table where they had been drinking moments before. They're all naked, stripped of their gold-embroidered uniform. Victor drops to his knees, and his eyes well with tears.
"We're doomed,"
Victor says. "Not yet," Jean says, and steps over the bodies. He lifts the edge of the blood-soaked tablecloth and covers Berthier's twisted face.
"What will we do now?"
"First, we bury them. Then, we go home." Victor leaps up to his feet and wipes away his tears.
"Home? You want to go home? After what they did to our friends?
I say we hunt them down and kill them all." "Get a hold of yourself," Sean says.
"I'd like to know your opinions," Victor says. The sun hasn't quite risen over the gray-brown mountains of the Hindu Kush, and the air is brisk and cold. A light layer of snow has dusted the ground. The officers scuff their feet and look away.
"No, I'm serious. I want to know what you all think we should do. Do you want to go home? Do you want to go to India? What?"
"Home," a lieutenant says. He looks down at his feet, as though embarrassed by his own words. You follow his eyes and notice that he doesn't have any shoes. Some of the officers do this to show solidarity with their soldiers.
"Home. Anyone else? Anyone have a different opinion as to what we should do?"
No one speaks.
"Well, I have an idea. I stayed up all last night and I thought it through. My idea is that we do exactly as our emperor would want. He may be sick, he may not be able to lead us now in person, but he can still lead us by the strength of his will. And his will is that we should go to India."
The men grumble.
"Now look, I know you're feeling demoralized, but this really is the best option. India is right over there, just a few days' march through the pass. And once we're in India, we'll have everything we need. India is a fat land full of food and loot."
"There's plenty of food back home," the lieutenant says, finding his voice again.
"Let me get this straight. You want to walk all the way back to Russia when winter's just starting. You don't even have shoes. Look, India doesn't have winters. It's warm like a Brazilian beach all year round. And you know the rumors. Even the poorest villagers wear gold. You shake down one village and you have enough to retire."
Jean's face is red and he can hardly contain his anger. "Can I speak freely, sir?"
"Yes, of course, Sergeant."
"Your plan is fantasy. I think you've forgotten about the Khyber Pass."
"The Khyber Pass, the Khyber Pass. You've been moaning about the Khyber Pass since we left Moscow."
"I say, we reconnect with our supplies in Kabul. We can winter there. It's very defensible."
"Where is your corps d'esprit? How old are you, Sean? 50? You've been fighting alongside Napoleon since last century, and all you are is a sergeant. You ever wonder why you never advanced further? It's because you are a fearful man, Jean.
I protect the Emperor.
Well, then protect him, and let the masters of strategy lead the army.
I should kill you for those words.
But you won't, because you never attack. You defend.
The officers stand aside, probably wondering if there will be a duel. Jean's chest heaves as he tries to regain his composure. Finally, he stands up straight and looks the Polish colonel in the eyes. There isn't a stone in that pass that hasn't been soaked in blood.
Jean, you should have been an actor.
And how would you cast me?
How about Cassandra blathering about bad omens?
I don't think you realize what you just said.
All right. How about Don Quixote, then? You're the one living a fantasy, Jean, not me. The Khyber Pass is just a windmill. It's nothing. You're embarrassing yourself in front of all these soldiers, pretending it's a giant.
Jean's face turns purple, and his eyes glare. His knuckles are white around his rifle, but he doesn't say a word.
All right, then. It's settled. Let's pack up and head to India.
Alexander's troops felt like, Jean says. You're walking towards the mountains. They're gray-brown and pocked with scrubby specks of vegetation. Beyond them lie the great snow-capped mountains of the Hindu Kush, the claws of the Himalayas. The soldiers around you hardly talk, march forward, grim and uncomfortable. The only sounds you can hear are the wind, the marching, and the popping gunfire from behind as the Persians pick off stragglers.
What do you mean by that?
You say.
Huh? About Alexander's troops.
Oh, well, it was about here that they started to have mutinous thoughts. They wanted to turn around and go home.
But they made it, didn't they? They got to India.
Yes, they did.
And how many did Alexander have? 20,000, 30,000? Well, we have 300,000.
We'll see if that matters.
Who was it that said, quantity has a quality all of its own?
I don't know. I can see that being relevant in the Prussian heartland.
But not in the Khyber Pass.
When your army is surrounded, you're doomed. When the enemy commands the high ground, you're doomed. When your soldiers start to shit their pants and run, you're doomed. And that's what's going to happen in those mountains. It won't matter if we had a million men. They're all going to die.
That's dark, Sean. I really hope you're wrong.
Just think of your family and pray you have a quick death.
Is that what you're going to do if we get ambushed? You aren't going to fight?
Oh, no, I'll fight. As long as the Emperor's alive, I'll protect him with the last drop of my blood.
You set up camp at the edge of the Khyber Pass. A planet begins to shine faintly in the darkening sky. You have a flashback of being on the exoplanet with the robot. You remember many nights spent looking up at the strange constellations and wondering which distant star was home. Now, on the night before entering the Khyber Pass, you have that same strange feeling of unquenchable homesickness. You could simply walk away, live off the land like you did on the exoplanet for 7 years, and just wait it out. It shouldn't take that long to be sucked out of this world and back home. You hear the crack of a distant rifle and are reminded that the Persians are out there hunting down dreamers like you who don't feel this is their fight. You look over to the mouth of the Khyber Pass. In some trick of the mind, you swear you saw teeth. You rub your eyes. No, not teeth. It was just the way the moon shone on the stones. But from this angle, the mountains really do look like giants. You wonder how long they've been asleep. It takes 2 full days for Napoleon's army of India to be consumed by the Khyber Pass. All 300,000 enter the mountains as the snow begins to settle. Men grimace at the cold, and the number who are hobbling on makeshift crutches or being dragged by their friends seems to multiply. Real hunger is also overtaking the army. No longer able to spread out and forage across the vast, arid plains, soldiers now have to make do with what few rations they have, and many have nothing. At night, there are no smells of food in the camp. After a fruitless hunt for a meal, you search for Jean. You find him at his usual post in front of Napoleon's tent. He's peering through the flap. "How's he looking?" you say. Jean turns with a guilty expression on his face, as though he were caught committing a crime. He quickly regains his composure. "He's sleeping like a baby." Tears well in his eyes. "Want to take a look?" he says. This makes you a bit nervous. You haven't seen Napoleon in weeks. The last time you saw him, he was swaying on his Bactrian camel in a feverish trance. His eyes were bloodshot and his stubble was patchy and gray, masking his baby face with that of a sick old man's. "I don't know," you say. "How does he look? Any better?" "Well, you be the judge." You look through the tent flap. The walls flicker with light from a small military lantern that hisses and pops as though it were burning some airborne disease. And it might well be. The air is muggy with sweat and acrid with traces of vomit. Napoleon looks like death. His skin is white and shrink-wrapped against his cheekbones. His cracked lips have curled back to reveal his teeth and gums. The sallowness of his skin only makes his Italian nose look more pronounced. Seeing him this way is like jumping into a cold river, or like being shot. Your heart pounds. You feel tears of pity fill your eyes. On this long journey from Moscow, you were completely charmed by Napoleon. Even though you only had one conversation with him, and it was short, he's always called you by name. You're just one of 300,000, Yet Napoleon has a way of making you feel like you're the only one that matters. You always felt a warm sensation in his presence. It wasn't until this moment that you realize this feeling is love. "My God," you say, "is that really Napoleon?" You hear choking sobs. Closing the tent flap, you see Jean, his hand over his eyes, his mouth contorted, tears streaming down his cheeks. Seeing the big, stalwart man cry so openly, right there in front of the toughest, loyalist, and most stoic of the Imperial Guardsmen, hits you right in the heart. You feel the hot tears forming in your own eyes. You cover them with your hands. Rise up the mountain pass. The thin air is tough to breathe, and you can never seem to get enough of it into your lungs. Your pack feels like a piano, and your legs are wires. Your whole body quivers each time you strain at just one more step. The scenery is drab and dead, the arid walls of the cliffs uninspired. You spend hours simply looking down at your feet. The worn soles of your shoes are shredded to ribbons. During the first few hours of the morning, you could feel every pebble, thistle, and stone. Hot blisters burst, reformed, and burst again. But as the sun now rises above your head, your feet are as numb as wooden stumps. You find the physical exertion strangely cathartic. Old emotions boil up from dark places deep inside. Things you did, mistakes you made, or horrible things you witnessed. You keep cursing as another memory rises from your stomach like a boiling hot bubble, up your chest, into your lungs and throat, and then popping in your head, leaving Satya to die on the cross. Pretending you were the deliverer of Deep City, only to run away. Abandoning your own child to the endless winters of the Ice Age. You shake these memories off, curse at them, and wait for the next to explode. You vow to do something good, something meaningful that will make up for all your cowardice. How many have died? How many lives were destroyed because you ran? A faint voice of dark logic seeps through you and reminds you that these worlds are not your own. You would never be so cowardly in your own world. You'd never abandon your own family or friends. They're real. These people are not. They're shadows from a different universe. And you're just visiting. Just a tourist in time. The logic doesn't stick. These people are real. And you've hurt too many of them. So what will you do? Quit? Or start treating them like real human beings? Drop the tourist facade and really, truly enter these worlds. You remember back to your first time travel adventure. What were those words? Become the people you're exploring. Yes, yes, that's the answer. Of course, you were a coward before, but not anymore. From now on, you'll throw yourself heart and soul into these worlds. If you should die, well, then you will hope to die well. The sound of a rifle echoes through the ravine. Then, the sound of a trumpet. You don't recognize the call, but you're sure it isn't from a local Pathan instrument. It's much too crisp. Exhausted, gaunt-faced French soldiers look up at the cliffs, their wide, panting mouths agape like helpless chicks. More rifle fire and the distant roar of a war cry. Something wet splashes you in the eyes, blinding you. The man in front of you collapses, knocking you off balance. You fall to your knees and grab your eyes. Men panic around you, and you're bumped over. You're unable to see the feet that trample you, and you curl into a ball, trying to protect your body from the crushing mob. The English word, fire, is followed by a deafening volley. Men collapse on top of you, then more on top of them, crushing you. Frenchmen scream high-pitched, the dying for their mothers, the living for mercy. Another volley, and more men collapse on top of what now feels like a mountain of bodies crushing you. A man falls on your head, pressing your mouth to the earth. Warm liquid pours from the man, on your face, over your eyes, in your mouth. The taste is blood. It pools around your face, and you start to choke on it. In desperation, you pull your robotic arm free and lever the man. He rolls off your head, and you crawl out of the opening. You still can't see due to the sticky liquid in your eyes. Another volley, and you hear the rifle balls slap the earth and the bodies around you. You stop trying to pull yourself free, and instead, play dead. Slowly, very slowly, you wipe the blood from your eyes. There are bodies of Frenchmen everywhere, heaped up in piles like the one you're under. There, upon the edges of the cliff, are Scottish riflemen, red uniforms and great helms made of black bear fur. They lift their rifles and cheer, obviously having cleared this section of the pass of life. They move along the cliff edge, probably down into the valley somewhere up ahead. You don't wait to find out. You pull yourself out from under the bodies and run as fast as you can, leaping over mountains of corpses, down the hill, trying to get out of the tight ravine. Down the path you hear the sounds of thunder. The ravine spreads into a wide valley you had walked through only an hour before. It had contained a long line of men when you passed through it, but now it's bristling with soldiers and guns, and the sight is bewildering. Here is a full-scale battle, and it's growing larger by the minute as men rush in. Every hill is clogged with soldiers, horses, pack animals, and guns. Puffs of smoke erupt from cannons that blast holes in the thick morass. The sound is ear-piercing. The very earth rumbles like a constant earthquake from the roaring drum roll artillery. Your teeth feel loose as they chatter in your mouth. The valley is in utter chaos. Who could possibly hold their composure in such a calamity, you think? It's not difficult to convince yourself to turn and run. But as you move back up the narrow canyon, you see the Scottish guardsmen with their great bear fur helms barreling down towards you with bayonets fixed. When the first soldier sees you, he raises his rifle and fires. You duck just in time. The walls of the canyon leave you only one option. You run back to the valley and are engulfed by the battle. When you were a teenager, a friend invited you to a Hell Riot concert. You ended up in a muddy pit where hyper-aggressive men with full-body tattoos and shaved heads slammed into each other. Within moments, your nose was broken and you had to run out. Entering this battle brings flashbacks of that Hell Riot concert. But this, of course, is much worse. The soldiers swing hatchets, stab with swords and knives, and lance each other with bayonets. Their movements are violent. Some controlled, others panicked and flailing. Moving through them, you're constantly pushed and shoved, elbowed and kneed. Time seems to slow down by half as you dodge the lethal blows while sustaining painful hits and kicks. The French in the front ranks are trying desperately to push back into their own lines, while those deeper in press them out. It's like a human riptide. As you're sucked in, you're curled and tossed violently as the mass turns on itself. You try to push your way into the safety of the deep ranks, but the press forces you down, and then you're on the ground again, trampled by bare feet and ragged boots, eye level with the wounded and the dead. After an exhausting crush, you manage to press yourself to your knees, using the strength of your robotic arm. French soldiers fall over like waves breaking against a lighthouse, and it's all you can do to stay fixed in place. The press slows down and is now moving in the other direction. Now's your chance. You claw your way up a soldier's uniform, like a rock climber. You press in. The smell of sweat and fear and blood is on everyone. Their eyes are huge and terrified. The men thin out, and you're in a kind of corridor between units. There's still people everywhere, but now they're a mix of French and English again, and the fighting is fierce. You pick up an axe buried in the chest of a Frenchman. A redcoat, who looks like a grounded cavalry officer, charges you with his sword. You duck and whirl your axe at his legs. Your robotic arm cleaves at them with industrial strength, easily cutting through the man's thighs. He falls in a clump. A Gurkha runs at you with his bayonet pointed at your chest. You swing the axe, and his rifle cracks in two, the force of the blow throwing the man to the ground. You raise your robotic arm and slam the axe down. The Gurkha rolls, and your axe breaks on the rocks. Without losing a beat, the Gurkha pulls his long, curved blade from his belt and lunges at you. You turn, and the blade lodges in your spine. You panic for a second, then remember the Tetsuo replaced your spine with a cybernetic mod. A backwards blow from your robotic elbow turns the Gurkha's face to pulp. There's a soldier on horseback, this one about to stab a Frenchman near you. You grab the officer by the boot and yank him off his horse. He lands with a sickening crack on the rock. Jean-Francois waves at you. His mouth is moving, calling you, but you can't hear his words through the ear-shattering noise. You press towards him, weaving through the lethal brawls. A large square of French soldiers, five deep and bristling with bayonets, stands immovable in the chaos. The highly decorated soldiers, with their long gray mustaches, don't fire into the melee, but stand like heroic sentinels. This is the core of Napoleon's Imperial Guard. Jean leads you to a cannon at the corner of the square, and you squeeze your way along it until you're in a large, calm space, like the eye of a tornado. Here, medics treat the wounded, and boys prepare cartridges. At the center, surrounded by another smaller square of men, is Napoleon's tent. A cannonball smashes through the outer line, and a row of men are devastated. The ball bounces, whisking blood as it rolls to a stop near you and Jean.
"We hold here to the death,"
Jean shouts into your ear.
"For the Emperor,"
you shout back into his ear. You never thought you'd use those words, but they feel right. Just thinking of Emperor Napoleon fills your heart with an irrational pride and a sudden eagerness to die in battle. Jean takes your hand and holds it tight. His eyes must mirror your own.
"For the Emperor," he said.
"The Russians are coming," a messenger shouts. Jean grabs him by the throat and pulls him to eye level.
"What do you mean the Russians are coming?"
"Green uniforms. They're pushing into the canyon."
"Good God. But haven't we got enough to deal with?"
"The Persians, too."
"The Persians? Where?"
The messenger points in the distance to the hills, which are crawling with shimmering ants. These are armored cuirassiers, a vestige of the Middle Ages.
"Merde,"
Jean says and drops the messenger. He paces back and forth. The soldiers of the line part, and Victor rides through on horseback. His blue uniform is speckled with blood and soot, and his long golden hair is damp with sweat. He trots up to you and Jean and dismounts. The two men start yelling at each other, but judging from their red faces and the spit flying from their lips, it's not good. Jean punches Victor in the face, and he falls to the ground, blood splattered across his cheek from a bent nose. Victor leaps up and pulls his sword. Jean pulls his own, but the Polish cavalry officer easily disarms the elder man. Victor raises his blade. You put out your robotic arm and catch it before it can strike Jean's neck. Your fingers close around the blade, and it crumples. The two men turn and stare at you with disbelief. The way they look at you triggers something inside you. The respect, the awe. You remember the giants, how you led them in battle, winning victory after victory all across Africa. You remember how they treated you at first with disdain, then respect, then awe. You became a living god, and your word carried the weight of life and death. You lean into Victor.
"Do you have any cavalry left?"
you yell into his ear. He nods. Still stunned.
"Take them and destroy the Persians coming down that hill," you say.
Victor leaps on his stag and races out of the square in the direction of the Persians. You lean into Jean.
"Plug the ravine and stop the Russians."
"But with what army?"
"Find them. Lead them."
He looks incredulous, but starts walking. You step after him.
"Just start walking towards the Russians. Soldiers will follow you."
Jean salutes and runs out of the square. Napoleon stands in front of his tent. He nods at you. The sun sets as the gunfire rumbles through the hills in a slow decrescendo, like a god of war yawning and settling down to sleep. Between the intermittent popping and booming can now be heard the cries of the wounded. The hills and valley are filled with them, red-uniformed British, blue French, green Russians, and the exotic colored silks and armor of the Persians form a patchwork quilt of suffering. Jean and Victor walk into the square holding hands. Victor has a limp from a thigh wound. They both look exhausted and are even more covered in blood and soot than they had been before. You two are friends again? You say. They smile.
We crushed the enemy, Victor says. The Persians were no match for our cavalry.
He pulls a flag from his coat, a red flag with a lion and sun.
The Shah is dead.
Yes, Sean says.
Then this marvelous man swung around and attacked the Russians from behind.
Jean pulls out a flag of his own, a two-headed black bird on a yellow background.
Tsar Alexander is dead. Jean killed him in single combat,
Victor says, beaming with pride, kissing him on the cheek.
Now that is esprit de corps.
You smile at them and take their hands, standing in a circle.
We both agree that you should be our new general. You showed true leadership, and it was your resolution that won the day.
Yes, Sean says, the army is yours. I have something to share with you as well, you say. The Duke of Wellington's sword. The men's faces light up. They look to your empty belt.
Where is it? Victor says.
Over there. Napoleon sits on a chair, his feet resting on a drum. When he sees the men notice him, he smiles and rises on shaking limbs. His aides rush to help, and he pushes them away. Jean rushes to Napoleon. He bends down on one knee and kisses his hand.
Rise, Field Marshal of France. Do not bend like a servant to me. Stand tall and proud.
My Emperor, you must imagine me as someone else. Your marshals are all dead. I'm just an officer in your guard.
No, you are Marshal. All three of you are marshals.
Napoleon looks in your eyes, each in turn. Even though he is weak and skeletal, with a wild gray-black beard, you can't help but feel your heart flush. You bow to stop him from seeing your eyes tear up. Jean and Victor do the same.
Napoleon, Victor says, you have won the day. Your enemies have all been vanquished. Where would you have us go now?
India, of course.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. I'd like to thank Cryochamber for the rich, dark ambient music you heard in this show. I'll post links in the show notes on the Twilight Histories website. If you enjoyed this show and you want to hear more, there is a store with tons of time travel adventure stories just waiting for you to download. When you purchase a story from the store, you help support this show. And I really appreciate it. Writing time travel adventure stories for you is something I'd like to do for a living, and building up the store, we can hope to get there one day. So please visit twilighthistories.com, click on the store, and browse all the titles. I'm sure you'll find something you'll like. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to The Twilight Histories with Jordan Harbor.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.